Welcome to Forensic Forecast. I'm Lee, and joining us today, we have a special guest of Jad from Magnet Forensics, no longer Jad Software. How are you doing, Jad?
Good. Thanks for having me here today, Lee.
Yeah, not a problem. We're happy to have you. Where exactly are you based out of?
We're in Waterloo, Ontario, Canada, which is about an hour west of Toronto and the home of BlackBerry, or whatever that's worth now.
It's cool. I noticed it was starting to get dark behind you, and it's still quite light here. So,
yeah.
Awesome. All right, and also joining us today, we have Tom Yarish. How are you doing, Tom?
I'm doing all right. I'm a little tired, but other than that, I'm okay.
It's been one of those weekends.
No, I took the kids to their first Cubs game today, and we just got back like an hour or two ago. So.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, hence the hat.
You know, I find that if you take anyone to a baseball game, that they are going to feel pretty tired afterwards.
Yeah.
That's just my personal view. All right, cool. All right, well, so, Jad, we're going to spend a little bit of time talking about the latest developments over at Magnet Forensics today. So why don't you tell us a little bit about what's going on there and what your new venture that you've just been talking about the last couple of days is.
Sure. So we're getting close to releasing a new I guess edition of IEF, and we've got some new features on the PC side, but the thing that we're really excited about is moving into the mobile space now. So for the last year or so, when we're at conferences, people that we've talked to at our booth and just over email as well, been asking us to, when are you going to start, supporting mobile images, doing kind of the searches that you do on hard drives on an image of an iPhone or an Android phone, or, if you only get a logical file system dump, being able to search that. And so that's something we've been working on for a while now, and we'll be rolling that out pretty soon. And the kind of key thing that we'll be doing that we feel is kind of either not being done very well right now, or not being addressed, is recovering deleted data from physical images. So deleted SMS, deleted voicemails, and then a lot of deleted data from third-party apps like Facebook, Snapchat, and that kind of thing.
Okay, so you're taking basically this whole IAF concept of this is what we do whenever we, of computer-based social media, and then you're taking it now onto mobile devices. So
yeah.
That's cool. I like that. So, what do you think? I mean, is this where I guess you talked quite a lot about this at CEIC, and mm-hmm. We've seen some screenshots of what we think this is going to look like. So, how much different is this going to be for people who are used to using IAF?
Yeah, the great thing is that for people that are used to using IEF, there's very, very little difference in how the data is displayed and how they use the product to search for it. So on the main screen, there'll be a new button now that's called mobile. When you click on that, it'll ask you if it'll have two other icons for Android and iOS. So once you select that, then you select the button indicating if you have a physical image or if you have a folder of a file system that you want to search. Then once you add that in, go to the next screen, it'll show you all the different applications that we support on either iOS or Android, depending on what you've selected. Or if you've selected one of each, then you'll get both screens showing you the applications. So just, everything's checked by default as usual, and then go to the next screen, enter in where you want to save everything and hit go, and you get the same report viewer and the same kind of format of displaying results and being able to export them and view them in a timeline, view them on a world map for things that have geolocation in the metadata. So it's going to be very simple and very kind of as it is right now for searching PC or Mac images. So I've tried to keep it as simple as possible, which is kind of what we try to do across the board.
That's awesome. So this preview, which you've given to us, essentially to see all the screenshots and everything else, when do you think we can expect to see that being rolled out?
It's kind of in the final stages now of QA and release candidate testing. So we're hoping in about two or 3 weeks that it'll be officially released. So
nice.
By the end of this month.
All right. So how many, you talk about third party apps and the like. So what exactly is this going to support? I mean, it looks like from some of the screenshots that I've seen, it has text messages, which is obviously going to include stuff like iMessage for iPhones and so on and so forth. But what else? You mentioned Facebook and everything else. What are some of these other third-party apps that it's going to support?
We tried to hit all the kind of the really popular ones, so Facebook, Twitter, Google, like Gmail, native email, Snapchat, Foursquare. So a lot of the kind of the really popular apps, WhatsApp, and again for the ones that we could, we've built in carving for them as well. So while you might have app support for those applications using your other tools, you know, there's a lot of great tools out there right now for mobile forensics. So while they may support those apps, we'll take it another step further and do the carving piece that we've been doing, you know, a lot of on the PC side. And kind of extending that to the mobile side. So hopefully you'll be seeing a lot more deleted data that you weren't able to get before, that it was, you know, really time consuming. That's kind of the key thing that we're in.
Very cool. So is it going to be like, I know that whenever you load up IEF now on a computer, for example, and run it over an image or a mounted drive or something like that, it does take a little bit of time, depending on how many options you select to start carving. Is it going to be a similar kind of thing whenever you plug in an iPhone or an iPhone image? Is it going to take some time to run, or are you going to get to see some of this data pretty much instantaneously?
Yeah, I mean, depending on where the data is found, you know, we'll start at the beginning of the image and start going, and you'll be able to see results as it's found. You know, with version 6, we added multi-threading, and so if you have, you know, 32 logical cores, CPU cores on your system, we can take full advantage of those now. You can also reduce that if you want to still be able to use the system while it's searching. But you know, with that multi-threading now, the searches have really really sped up, and you know, a mobile image is generally going to be a lot smaller than a hard drive. So a lot of times you'll be able to kind of get it going, and within an hour, you know, it'll be done, even for a very large, you know, iPhone image or something like that. So I think people will be pretty happy with the speed now as well.
Very nice. So let me ask you a difficult question then. So we have things like Cellebrite and XRY and MP+ and all these things which are all kind of crowding into this mobile space now. What made you decide that this is the area that you guys wanted to move into next after doing all of the social stuff on the computer?
Yeah, it seemed kind of like the logical, you know, next progression for IEF, and again, it was largely based on user feedback and requests, and we try to get in touch with our users at the trade shows and conferences, and you know, over email throughout the year to find out, you know, what do you want us to add to IEF, or what kind of apps or platforms do you want us to support. And overwhelmingly, people were asking us to add, you know, do what you do on computers, exactly the same way on mobile images. And you'll still need your Cellebrite or your XRY to get the image or get the logical file system dump from the phone. And those are great tools. But then we can just kind of take the analysis portion a little bit further and provide you, you know, more data than maybe you were getting before. So that was kind of, again, like we're targeting unallocated space on the image, especially kind of the key differentiator that we'll be offering. And that's kind of what we're hoping people will see as a advantage over what the tools that they have now are giving them.
Very nice. That's cool. I mean, this is part of what I think is where we're inevitably heading. I mean, we've got we have all these nice computer tools, we have all these nice mobile phone tools, but there's very, very few which actually couple together. I mean, there's like FTK is probably a good example when you partner it with MPE Plus, but once again, you're still kind of using different tools to do that analysis. So, I mean, I honestly think that line between computing forensics and mobile phone forensics is starting to become very, very blurry. So,
yeah, absolutely. It's I mean, you see all the stats about tablet sales going up, and computer PC sales going down. And I think the PCs will always be there. You know, laptops, desktops. There's a place for them, but we're definitely going to start seeing and already are seeing a lot more mobile devices. So, being able to, if you're getting a case that's involving a computer and two cell phones, being able to process them together, view the data together, you know, whether it be on a timeline or on a map or while you're doing keyword searches through the results, it's just, something that I think most people want to be able to do and something that'll be very helpful in investigations.
Very cool. So with the introduction of the mobile stuff, is it possible you can look at both the mobile and the computer stuff together in the same interface, or do you have to kind of do it one device at a time?
No, when you set up your search, if you've got a hard drive image, you load that in, and with all the options you want for that image, and then you've got a couple phones or just one that you want to search, and if you want to view them together, you can add that in as well before you start the search, and then walk away and let it go through. All the results will be in one case file, and you can view them all together, so you can kind of overlay different data on a timeline or just see, different chat messages that may be, usernames or email addresses that are kind of crossing over from the PC side to the mobile side. If you wanted to separate them out, you could do that too, but I think viewing them together will be very valuable to a lot of people.
Very nice. So, and then what kind of support is there for mobile devices? It looks like it may just be Android and iPhone at the moment. Any plans to expand further than that in the future?
Yeah, right now we decided to go with Android and iOS-based devices, so iPhones, iPads, and, Android tablets or phones. We definitely want to expand into the Windows Phone side, maybe BlackBerry, as we go. We just want to be able to do each platform really well before we say that we support it. So we thought we'd lead with Android and iOS, and then as we continue to iterate on IEF and the mobile support, we'll add those other platforms in and be able to do the same kind of thing on those. So it's definitely on the roadmap.
Very nice. Just also as well, while we have you here, there was a press release a few weeks ago about Lance Mueller joining you. I know he was supposed to be on here this evening, but he must be lost somewhere around the internet.
Yeah.
So Lance has been, obviously he's got a wealth of experience, he worked for Guidance, he did training of his own accord, out in the Far East and so on and so forth. What kind of stuff are you looking for bringing Lance in to your company?
We wanted to kind of strengthen the, you know, the forensic examination experience and investigation experience in the company. And Lance, you know, beyond just being a great guy, is you know, has a wealth of experience in the law enforcement side and the corporate side, you know, on the training side. And, you know, we were introduced through a mutual friend, and it just we kind of hit it off right away, and it really made sense to kind of, you know, bring him onto the team, and he really was he really gelled with us too, and really was excited about it. So he's going to be he's going to be adding a lot of value, I think, in kind of the research we're going to do, the product development. He's working on developing some training right now, so I think that's something we've been asked about a lot, especially on the side of, you know, interpreting the results and the artifacts. The program itself is fairly easy to use, but you know, people want to know more about what they're seeing in the results, and so he's working on that as well, and a lot of other things too, to kind of bring more to our customers and just bring more value overall to what we're offering through the software.
Very nice. So I know that this is probably something that a lot of people have thought over the years, dealing with various pieces of forensic software, but do you think that a lot of companies need something like that? Need someone like Lance, not necessarily Lance himself, but someone like him who has similar kind of experiences to come in and actually give direction as to what kind of forensic features forensic software needs to focus on, rather than just kind of being like, well, we kind of like this, so we'll do some of this and we'll do some of that. You think a lot of people are kind of missing the boat on that at the moment?
Yeah, I mean, I can't think of any that I would say, you know, this company's missing the boat on that right now. But I think it definitely is a great thing to have. And you know, I have my experiences, my forensic background from the law enforcement field, and you know, and software. But you know, one person, you know, most of the time, I would say, doesn't have all the answers, and bringing in someone else that has, you know, a really great track record and a lot to offer in that area, I think can do nothing but help, you know, help you serve your customers better, or serve, you know, whoever you're dealing with, your clients, you know, in a better way. So I think absolutely it's a great thing if you can bring on the right people to you know, be another you know, another point of contact or another perspective on what you're developing, or what, you know, what kind of needs that your customers or clients might have. So I think it's a very helpful thing, and it's already proven, you know, with Lance to be a really great value add to our business internally. For, you know, I'll tell our developers that, you know, hey, the software needs to work this way, or forensic examiners aren't going to be happy if we don't do this. And you know, they listen to me, mainly because they have to, but they do listen to me. But it's great having another person to say, you know, yeah, based on my experience and here's a story, you know, that's why we need to focus on these areas for our customers, or we need to make sure the software looks like this. And it's just a great thing to have.
That's awesome. So let's see. I mean, it can't have been more than what, 3 years or something since, maybe 4 years or so since JAD Software first
appeared. 4 years, yeah.
So
yeah, about 4 years.
So there's lots of people out there who, you know, who tinker around with code for forensics and everything else, and you seem to have just found that little niche where you just seem to have found a fantastic market for this and built a company off from that. What advice can you give to people who may be looking for, you know, creating their own forensic software, or, you know, trying to get into more like the service side of the field rather than the actual investigations?
Yeah, I mean, I can give you my perspective on it. I certainly don't claim to have all the answers or the best answers, but for me it was always about finding a way to help people, in their examinations. I saw a need for a tool, to recover this kind of data from hard drives that wasn't really out there, and find that kind of that pain point or that gap that's not being addressed by other tools is, I think, the most important thing, because if you're making something that nobody really needs or necessarily cares about, then it might be a good academic exercise, but depending on what you're wanting to do with what you're creating, it may not go the way that you want it to. And then the key thing that I've always kind of from the beginning been really obsessive about is keeping things simple. And I think digital forensics is a very complicated field, and there's very very technical, very difficult concepts to get your head around sometimes. And that's fine. That's how that should be, because it is what it is. But if something can be simple and there's no reason for it not to be simple, I think you're just overcomplicating things for no reason. So, when it comes to the user interface or just, what you're asking the user for, if it's something that can be simplified, I think it should be. And, always letting a, forensic examiner who's a very technical person get to the details behind the scenes or where you found something or how you found it, that's very important, and you always want that available. But I think simplicity is a key thing that's missing in a lot of software out there today. So those are kind of two things that I would say that I focused on.
Yeah, I think that not just newcomers to the field, but quite the institutional forensic software producers could probably take a few tips from that as well. It's the KISS principle: get simple, stupid. So
yeah, that's right. Yeah.
Very cool. All right. Well, that's awesome. So you say a few more weeks until the new version of Internet Evidence Finder is available, or after the testing is finished. But so are we going to see price increase with the new functionality? Is it going to stay the same? How do you see that panning out?
So what we're doing, because this is kind of a new platform that we have to support and have had to do a lot of work on, is we're creating a new edition of IEF called IEF Advanced. And right now we have Standard and Triage. So what's going to happen is everyone that has a license currently for Standard will get grandfathered in to Advanced until their maintenance expires. And then what they can do at that point is decide if they want to renew at the Standard rate or at the Advanced rate. And it's really not going to be that much more at all, but we're giving people the choice, and in the meantime, they get it for free. So there'll be a slight price increase for that functionality to get the mobile ability, but most people will get it for free for the rest of their contract, their maintenance contract, and then they can make the decision from there if they want to keep it or not.
Very cool. All right. So where can people find you if they're interested in getting your software?
So they can go to magnetforensics.com, request a trial there. They can contact us if someone wants to get any more information about what we're going to be doing with this new edition. They can contact us for more information. I'm always available if someone wants to email me, jad@magnetforensics.com. Happy to answer any questions or help people out where I can. And I know Lance is very open to that as well. And it's just lance@magnetforensics.com. So unfortunately he couldn't be here today, but he was hoping to. So maybe another time. But that's where you can reach us, and we're happy to help in any way we can.
Yeah, oh, he's been on before. He's been there, done that. So Usually, you know, usually this is a one-time experience for people. So, all right, cool. And then you guys also up for Forensic Forecast Award as well?
Yes. Yeah, so we're really excited to get nominated for that. Really appreciate everyone that put in nominations and really appreciate everyone that voted for us. So excited to see what happens with that. We were up against two really good tools, so I'm sure it wasn't an easy thing for anyone, but excited to see the results.
Okay, cool. Are you going to be there at the Forensic Summit?
I believe so. Yeah, have to just check the schedule, see what plan for me.
Alright. Awesome. Yeah. Well, you're welcome to hang around and listen to us talk about some other stuff if you want to. If you have other stuff to get to, then we understand that as well. So, if you want to hang around and chime in, then and feel absolutely free to do so.
Okay.
So
I do have to get going in a couple minutes, but I appreciate that. Thanks. And thanks again for having me on here tonight. I really appreciate it.
No problem at all. Thanks for joining us. It's been fun.
Yeah. Good to see you too, Tom.
Good seeing you.
Tom's not usually this
okay,
quiet.
Okay, take care.
Well, I didn't want to step over your questions and stuff. That's all. I was giving you a chance to do your interview.
All right. So that was into Evidence Finder, and it's a great tool. We use it at work, and it's like Chad said that this is quite a niche product where they've kind of really got that market pretty sewn up at the moment. So very, very cool. Other things that I want to talk about today. There was an interesting story in the LA Times this week about how companies that are victims of cyber attacks are now looking to retaliate against their attackers. Now, when I first heard that or first read that, I kind of went, no, what are you people thinking? I don't know, Tom, what was your gut reaction whenever I tell you that?
The retaliation thing?
Yeah.
You know, for me, I've been hearing it off and on for like the last year, and it's one of those things. It's not probably the best idea to escalate, because one, you never know if the person that you're going to turn around and retaliate is actually the one that's attacking you, or if it's just some unwilling pawn that's been, you know, owned in one way, shape, or form. Two, it's always the story of, you know, there's that line that the good guys, quote unquote, never cross, and now you're crossing it and going after them. You also, I mean, unless you know your adversary very, very well, you don't know what you're getting into once you, you know, fire that retaliatory shot. You know, it could be one of those things where you have the, you know, in the cartoons and stuff where you have the little puppy come up and start barking at you, whatever, and the cat would come along and kick the puppy out of the way, and all of a sudden you have this, you know, 10-ton dog that comes up behind it that's the mother and, you know, squashes you or whatever. You know, so those are always the concerns that I have. And in our line of work, that's not really what we do. We kind of find out what happened and how to prevent it from happening again. Our job is not to turn around and start getting back at whoever, you know, did X, Y, and Z to us.
Yeah. The other thing which occurred to me is that this is like a worldwide game of whack-a-mole as well. Is that you can have these little things popping up and you can smack them with the hammer, but, you know, you hit that one and then straight away another one pops up somewhere else. I mean, you can try and stop these people and try and attack them back, but there's so many of these things happening on a daily basis now. I mean, surely all your time, like you said, must be spent trying to defend from these things rather than actually going ahead and retaliating, because you can't possibly have the time to construct complex attack vectors and everything else whenever you're just trying to stop your own data from being stolen.
Yeah, it's one of those things. It starts to get in that slope that, you know, do you really want to go down it? Two, do you have the resources to go down it? I mean, how many teams in normal companies are already, you know, from a security standpoint, they don't have a lot of personnel to begin with. Now all of a sudden you're asking them to not only defend but also turn around and attack if need be, and it's one of those things that you start to get to a point where it's like, you know, when is enough enough?
It's certainly an interesting read this article. I would encourage people to go and have a look at it, but it tells you about some of the more interesting things that which companies get involved in for this kind of thing. Like Microsoft, for example, they take it to the courts. They find IP addresses for computers. They go in and they have those IP addresses essentially disconnected. But, I mean, that's Microsoft. They've got a huge budget for everything. And not everyone can do this. So, I mean, in some ways I can kind of see the reason why people would do this. But, I mean, really, I cannot see the long-term benefit of any company wanting to do this.
Well, I think the larger companies have the personnel to do it. And, you know, you start talking about Microsoft or Google or even Apple and those types of companies, you know, they have... Even Verizon or, you know, any of the carriers have more visibility into what's going on. And even the Microsoft stuff, I mean, they're at least partnering with government when they do it, so they're not actually the ones going in guns blazing. It's still law enforcement doing it. And it has to be, because they're the ones that have the agreements with the other countries that can, you know, do these sort of shutdowns. But they get messy. I mean, look at the whole mega upload thing. You know, they went in there basically guns blazing, and, you know, it's starting to fall back on them now.
That one's particularly messy at the moment.
Right, and, you know, it's imagine a smaller company turning around and doing something like that, and now they're getting sued. You know, so now, you know, your website was down for 24 hours, you lost confidence. Well, now you're being sued by some other person that you happen to, you know, piss off because you went around and started attacking them when they weren't the ones that actually were attacking you to begin with, and now you're sued out of existence. You know?
Why are people doing this? I mean, why? It's,
you know, it's the state of the world, and it's simply just an technology evolution as to what society was like, you know, 20 years ago. I mean, everyone's talking about it being another Cold War again between, you know, China and the U.S. And it's in the technology front instead of on a, you know, nuclear front. And they're probably right. And it'll probably escalate to a certain point. Will it turn into something like a world war? I hope not, but who knows? You know, but that's probably how things, if it does start, will start.
Yep. The report which the LA Times is referring to comes from a company called FireEye, and one of the co-founders, his name is Ashar Aziz. He said, "I don't think companies should be hiring gunslingers to fight back. Before we encourage every random company to hack, we have to look at what makes sense to disrupt cybercrime." So if this isn't the answer, you know, if we don't hire people specifically to fight back against these people who want to disrupt our businesses and steal company data or whatever else, what is a better way of providing that disruption to the cybercrime?
I don't know. I mean, I don't think turning around and being out, going on the offensive is necessarily it, for companies at least. You know, because then where do you draw the line? Especially because you figure, okay, the people you're going to hire to do this, you know, could potentially, or if they weren't already, were one of those people that were attacking other companies before. So now you know, it's the whole black hat, white hat type of thing, you know, so there's going to be trust issues there because, okay, well, let me get this straight. We hired somebody that was put in prison for 10 years for breaking into something so that he or she can defend us and go on the offensive when somebody attacks us. Okay. Now, in terms of what you can do about it, there's, you know, I'm certainly not the expert to speak on all of that. There's security people that are much better on Twitter than I am on that regard. But, you know, simple things like secure coding practices, you know, that's always been a big thing. Microsoft went on that big initiative. That's helped a bit, you know, but you still have, there's still these exploits that are out there that people are able to take advantage of, which is the underlying problem. Or you have people and companies that don't put the time and effort until there's an incident to actually secure their systems, because IT and security in general has always been, has not been a revenue generating function of a business. So there's not a lot of emphasis put on it until there's an incident. Then it's, oh my God, look what happened. We need to hire a whole bunch of people and start spending money to lock things down. And that's the wrong time to start doing it.
Closing the barn door after the horse has bolted.
Right.
Yeah. And I think that, you know, if you do this, you're certainly at risk of several things. First of all, you don't know how big or complex or how determined these people are that you're fighting back against, and how skillful they are. I mean, you don't want to piss off Anonymous, for example. But at the same time, you fight back against these people, and if you put a foot wrong doing this, you're breaking federal law. You could be investigated by the FBI, or whatever other agency, and you could end up in very serious trouble for this. So it's a very risky game to play.
Well, and the other aspect of that too is, kind of tying into that is, where do you draw the line? So you have a corporate entity that can turn around and essentially break the law, because you're dealing with, you know, how many statutes of, you know, crossing state lines, and you're crossing international lines even, and basically attacking someone else's stuff. And what's the difference between, you know, Joe computer criminal that's sitting in his basement with, you know, his six or seven servers around him doing the same thing? What's the difference?
Liability insurance?
Yeah. I don't know too many insurance companies that are going to cover that. They'll probably make money in it, though.
Yeah. No, I mean, you're exactly right. I mean, and I think that's an important thing. You know, I don't know if there'll be anybody who watches or listens to Forensic Forecast who may be involved in stuff like this, but it's certainly something to consider. If your employer asks you to do this kind of thing, you know, just because your employer tells you to do it is not going to give you any exemption from prosecution down the line. Right. So you've got to really watch your back and be very, very careful about what you do, regardless of whether someone's pressuring you to do it or not.
Well, and I don't know any legal counsel in their right mind that would say, yeah, sure, go ahead and do that. You got our sign off on that.
Yeah. At least no good ones.
Do we cheat them and how?
All right. So, yeah, I mean, that's just, it's crazy. And certainly would not advocate that at all. Please, if someone asks you to do that at work, you really need to inform them on the legalities of it, or get you your company in-house counsel to educate them on what the possible consequences of that are. But yeah, fun times. Mm-hmm. Yeah, speaking of fun times, this last week, or last week and a half, I guess, we've just found out that Google have been ordered to turn over their records to the FBI without a warrant. This is kind of scary because this is, you know, if you think through this logically, basically Google holds information on millions of people worldwide, and that data isn't just the stuff which sits in their mailbox or on Google Plus or anything else, but it's like all people, you know, everyone's browsing habits, pictures that they might have stored online. This seems crazy. I mean, why wouldn't the FBI need a warrant for this? It just seems absolutely ludicrous.
I think given the event over the last week, just not even with that, with the whole Prism thing coming to light and the other piece, that there's probably stuff that has been going on for quite some time that the cracks are starting to show. I mean, the part of it is a lot of people, I think, don't think about when they sign up for these services, be it Google or Facebook or Outlook or Apple stuff, is that once you do that and you start utilizing them, you lose control. And no matter what any kind of company will tell you about, no, everything's fine, don't need to worry about it, we value your privacy, you have lost control. And it's funny, I actually had a scary moment from a Google perspective, because I'm an Android user, I use Gmail and stuff like that, but my son was getting ready to do a modeling job, and my wife had emailed me the details and said, you need to print out this little voucher that they have to fill out at the shows, or the work areas to get paid, basically. And I didn't have it with me, so the scary part was I'm sitting there in my Gmail, and how they have it now with the person's profile that comes up that you're conversing with, and the last few images that person sent you. Well, this wasn't the last image that she had sent me, but what ended up coming up is in the little pictures underneath my wife's image was the voucher I needed to print out. And so I'm looking at Gmail, having a conversation about this, getting this voucher for this modeling job. There on the right-hand side of my browser window is the voucher I need. I can open that up in Google Docs and then print it using Google Cloud Print to my printer at home. And all this was done on a Chromebook. So it's...
On a what?
Sorry. Yeah, Chromebook. I actually have one. I have the cheap one. So it's, you know, you start looking at how all that stuff's tied together, and you know, in the end, we can start screaming about the privacy violations, which, yes, they are, but the other aspect of it is that we're giving another entity our information. And, I've had Gmail for so long, I don't recall, but I don't recall ever signing off on something one way or the other saying, yes, you can do whatever you want with my information. And you can argue both sides of that, but, you know, again, it's a free service. You sign up relatively in like 5 seconds, you know, and that's the way all the webmail services are. And you're essentially giving these people whatever you end up using it with. And who knows, you have no control over that once that's done.
Okay, so I get that, and I completely, I actually do agree with you. If you're using a free service, then you end up being the product that's being peddled, okay? And so your information out there is just your information out there, and you have no control over that. But we're not talking about just those users, though. We're also talking about, like, if you have Google Apps, which you pay for.
Not in every case, though. I have Google Apps, and I don't pay for it.
No, that's true, and I'm the same. I'm type when I don't pay for anything I can get away with. So yeah, I have Google Apps for the forensic forecast domain and stuff like that. But companies do pay. Education organizations do pay. And some government offices also pay for Google Apps. So right. That information, you would hope, would not be the same information which is turned over to the FBI if they receive one of these national security letters, or, you know, via PRISM, if such thing really does exist.
Right, and I think from that perspective, you know, when a corporation is using those types of services, they have more, there's a bigger picture that they have to deal with, where they can turn around and say, okay, now wait a minute, you need to tell us, you know, for example, if it's a healthcare company, because there's HIPAA regulations that we're have to follow, and are you talking about handing over potentially HIPAA data to the FBI without a warrant? You know, because we need to be concerned about that. So I think from a business perspective, they have a foot to say, kind of turn around and say, look, what we need a little bit more information about this. And it was even to the point where I was, there was one thing that happened. It was the Verizon thing that came out, where I was wondering if I should go back to my boss and go, hey, should we talk to Verizon about this whole phone call thing and see what they're doing? Is this something we need to be concerned about? Because of them giving away that, you know, the call records. And while they're trying to brush it off, it's still, okay, yeah, great. You know, you're saying this is the only thing they've given you, but we don't know that. You know, the trust level is starting to go down here, and the government's just like, no, trust us. But it's like, well, no, here's where we were trusting you when you started. Now things, but you're like, oh, just trust us, just trust us, just trust us. And it's like, yeah, it's starting to kind of fade there. And it's actually funny that all this is going on, because I've been rewatching. If you ever watched the show, TV show Sliders, where it's Jerry O'Connell, where you kind of go back and it's like multiple Earths on different dimensions, and so every time they go, it's a different type of Earth. And the court, it's kind of interesting how you see some of the scenarios that they've dreamt up for this show, and some of them are actually starting to come somewhat true.
Yeah. First of all, I just want to say that obviously your son gets his looks from his mother. Second of all, sorry, I was trying not. I was trying not to.
Okay. I see you go.
Second of all. You brought up PRISM as well, and I know that's been in the news quite a bit the last couple of days. It would seem, I mean, I don't want to cast doubt on things, I don't want to say this is BS or whatever else, but to me, it would seem a little strange that on one hand we're talking about PRISM, about all these companies blindly handing information over, but on the other hand we have Google in court protesting handing over information without a warrant when they appear to have been doing it all the time. So it just seems a bit, I don't know, those two different scenarios seem to be at heads to me, and I'd probably not put as much stock in the whole PRISM story as I do with this court order.
Yeah, and I haven't read all the details about the PRISM stuff yet. There was actually, I guess the person who blew the whistle on it or whatever finally spoke out today, and I haven't even had a chance to read what he said during that interview. I mean, it's, you know, it's one of these things that everybody makes fun of the government all the time, and it's like, you know, you kind of wonder how, if these things are true, how they could even pull them off, because everyone makes fun of, you know, how incompetent they are. You know, we can't balance a budget, but you know what? We can tap into some servers without any problems here, you know. So it's one of those things that who knows? You know, get Ovi on the show and ask him if he knows.
No. never. No, it's certainly interesting. And I think that you're exactly right. You put your information out there, and it's out there. You're going to lose control of that very, very quickly.
Well, and here's another thing, though, too, that it's funny that no one... It's one of these things, everyone kind of says, you know, all this data is being given out. And I posted this on my Google Plus page, and the Joy Tech comic did a perfect thing, where they did this whole comic about this person who was outraged about Verizon handing over this data and proceeded to post it on Twitter, on Facebook, along with their location, showing the picture of them on the beach or getting a coffee or eating lunch. And it was this whole string of stuff where you're basically giving out that information anyway. And it's weird the way the society seems to react on that. And sometimes I just wonder if it's kind of our smaller world, so to speak, that's really kind of outraged about this, whereas the rest of the general public either doesn't have a clue or just doesn't care. But again, it's okay, yes, the government may or may not be pulling all this information. What's to say Google, Microsoft, Apple, Facebook, all those other companies aren't going through all that information as it is?
No, we know they are. I mean,
but I mean, where's the outrage over that?
You know, well, there's no outrage because, and this is the thing, is because it helps to make things convenient. I mean, you're an Android user, you have Google Now.
Yep.
Yeah, I mean that right there, that thing reads your email, it reads all your, you know, whatever, calendar entries, to-do lists, everything, and it tells you, you know, oh, you have a flight coming up in 2 days. Would
it's
you like
time to leave for this appointment?
Yeah, and it gives you like directions to it and everything. So people don't care because it's making their lives easier, and so that's where the outrage goes. I mean, there's some people, you know, the hardcore security people that say, yeah, really, this is a bad idea. But people don't care because it's too convenient. What they get worried about, rightly or wrongly, is government having all of their private information to hand, because they don't know what the government is going to do with that. They know fine, well, most people know fine well that Facebook are going to target you with specific ads based on what you post, that, you know, Google...
Right, but that's what you're seeing on the surface, is because that is in your face in terms of that's what they're producing, so you know that's what they're mining for. Other than that, you have no clue what they're doing otherwise behind the scenes.
No, and we've Sergey and Gary, Sergey and Larry from Google have also said, you know, we would like to have like an island somewhere, essentially, right, where the laws and everything don't apply to us, so we can do what we really want to do. And you think, that's quite interesting. What kind of stuff do you mean? Right. So, yeah, and once again, I completely get that. But at the end of the day, people still see results from that. They don't see the results from what the government gets. You know, the stories where, you know, this information could be used to intercept some kind of attack on some country somewhere. You know, we don't hear those stories because they're usually covert. If they, you know, they might publish them, for example, and we'd have a good idea. Oh, well, then, you know, we know that because of that, they help to protect the country, help protect me and my family. So, and that's a possibility. But I think people just get scared about where the data is going and who's looking at it.
Well, and I think, you know, in some instances, I think people have a right to be nervous about it. But on the flip side, yes, I understand, you know, it's a very fine line that the government has to walk nowadays because, you know, on the one hand, they're trying to avoid another 9/11 or something like that. On the other, they have people saying, hey, I don't want you to be nosing in my business and know every single thing I'm doing, as I posted to Foursquare, Facebook, and whatever. You know, it's a very fine line for them to walk, and they're going to, it's going to be, it's going to keep going on for years. I mean, this is certainly not over. Again, I kind of wonder what it's going to be like in, 20 years when my kids are at that age, when, they're the ones making money and we're just retired sitting in a home and complaining about the good old days type of thing.
The home where, because they have all of your information already, they know when you get hungry, what kind of food you want before you can ask for it.
Right.
You can see both sides to this. I mean, there's the whole, well, we need to protect our country from another terrorist attack where thousands of lives could be lost or more. But then you've got people, saying, well, I don't want any of my information out there, et cetera, et cetera. Why do you have to spy on normal, everyday people? And then you've got the other part of this again where the government will say, well, if you haven't been breaking the law, you have nothing to hide, why are you so worried that we steal private data?
I've never agreed with that argument, but it's always, that's not the point. I think the reality of these days is if you do not want that happening to you, you just cannot be online. You can't be online. You have to pay for everything in cash. You can't own a car. You can't own a home. It's really, because otherwise, there's some system that has you in it.
Yeah. No, absolutely. It's certainly becoming a more information-oriented world that we're living in.
Well, and it's funny because I listened to the 2600 Off the Hook podcast. I've been listening to that for years, and they were doing yet another one of their fundraisers like a week or two ago, and they have this guy Steve Rambam that they've had on off and on, who I believe, and I could be mistaken, he's a private investigator, but his specialty and what he's done at the Hope meetings is, he basically will, you just give him your name and he will find out all this information about you from, like publicly accessible systems or systems that he has access to as part of his job. And it'll be, your email address, your social security number, your bank account numbers and all this information. That he actually did a social experiment 1 year at a Hope where he had somebody just give him his name, I believe, maybe his email address, I don't remember which, and he just pulled back all this information from this person in such a short amount of time. And here's someone who's not with the government able to do that.
Yeah, it is unusual. It's like I said, though, I mean, if people have got a better quality of life or in their eyes, then I think they're probably more than happy to give up some of their privacy. But I was having this conversation with someone today, and I thought the whole thing was kind of interesting, where they were saying how, they had their email, they had their Gmail broken into by someone and started sending out emails and everything from their account. So they found that out. They went in, they changed their password, they set up everything. I told them that, two-factor authentication is probably a good idea now that I started using it. And they were saying, well, what can I do to, encrypt my email? I'm like, well, you can do that. I mean, to be honest, I don't encrypt my email. If people want to read my email, I'm that desperate, then by all means, read it. It's not really that interesting. I'm not that interesting either. But if you encrypt stuff and you send that around, I just wonder how much of a target you're making yourself by doing stuff like that. Are you going to be the first people that people like, organizations like the NSA are going to look at whenever they want to know what's going on in the world, because you obviously have something to hide?
Well, and I think part of that is going to be patterns and behavior. If if someone, like, you know, like let's say yourself, you know, you've been using email regularly without any issues and no encryption, just using it as it is for years, and then all of a sudden you start encrypting everything, you know, I would probably say a lot of people in law enforcement would be suspicious of that. Now again, I'm not for law enforcement, so I can't say that for certain, but, you know, I'm sure that raises some concerns for them. But, you know, even if with encryption, it's there's two sides to it. You know, if you still have to have the person on the other side decrypting it. So, you know, who are you talking to? Who are you emailing it to? You know, if I'm encrypting email to my mom, they may not be as concerned about that. You know, it's I think there's a trade-off of convenience with what you're willing to give away. You know, how many times do you go to any kind of game and there's the person out there standing out saying, hey, if you sign up for this thing, you may win a free trip. And then they're calling you for like the next 7 years. You know, and the funny part when you're talking about two-factor is, you know, Twitter and Evernote, the two ones that I noticed, you know, the last couple of weeks have added two-factor. And, but it's tied to your mobile phone. So I'm like, okay, so now are you guys just harvesting phone numbers? Because now you have all these phone numbers. Because, every, you know, you're sending SMS codes to them. So what are you doing with that?
Yeah. They probably already have that anyway because of being able to send tweets via SMS anyway.
But, well, actually, and it's funny because I didn't actually have my mobile phone number I get tied to my Twitter account. And I usually use my Google Voice number for those sorts of things. I rarely ever give out my actual cell number.
That's probably not a bad idea.
Well, for me, it works better because, you know, for example, when you're talking about Google's two-factor, you know, if I don't have my phone with me, or like the other day or a couple weeks ago, my phone crapped out on me and I had to, you know, reflash it. If I have the backup codes tied to my Google Voice account, I'll get an email with the code. So I don't need my phone. I just need access to a computer.
That's pretty cool. So, yeah, like I said, I mean, I started using two-factor authentication. It kind of screwed me up a couple of days ago. I ended up having, I had to upgrade my phone from iPhone 4 to iPhone 5. I know it's a burden. But when I did that, I couldn't get into any of my accounts anymore. So it took a little while to figure that out and get everything working again. But, yeah, I mean, it's definitely worth it, for sure. So, yeah, that's... I just think that whole Google story is very interesting, and obviously that was some great insight there. Thanks, Tom. Appreciate that.
Well, it's more interesting just because of everything else that's coming out that's not directly related but in the same realm.
I did want to talk a little bit about the Cellbrite and Nuix thing, but I think we'll leave that for another time for now.
Because I haven't read about that yet.
You what, sorry?
I said good because I heard about it, but I haven't read about it yet.
I wish there was a way of putting up just a single picture on Google Hangouts here, because I just want to talk just quickly about the Logicube Forensic Talon, the new one which has just come out. Basically, it's an all-in-one solution, a bit like the Tableau TD3, where it allows you to image drives, and USB devices, image over network, image to network, all that kind of stuff. It very, very it sounds really, really awesome. And it comes at a fraction of the price of the TD3 as well. So it's very, very handy. But this is what I said, I wish I could put up a picture of it. But it looks like it's something off the display of like the Enterprise from Star Trek The Next Generation. The buttons are all like funny angles, and it looks like the... I'm going to really show myself to be geeky here, but that's called the LCARS display.
Mm.
And it just looks like it's been taken straight off the bridge of the Enterprise. It's just weird looking thing. I don't know if I can get past that.
We've been evaluating, we evaluated the dossier and their NetConnect, and we have the TD2 in the office. We just got a TD3, and it's for the separate, it's actually not related to the work I do. It's for more e-discovery related stuff. But they had told me about the, it's not a Talon though. I thought they were calling it something else. It's like Falcon or something?
Forensic Falcon, yeah.
Falcon, yeah. And so the person I was, from Logicube that I was talking to, I was like, oh, you know, could we get a demo unit? Because we literally just sent back the demo they sent us for the dossier. And I guess they're not actually going to have anything until next month. But from what I was reading, it looks like you can image from 4 source devices to, it was like 4 sources to 5 destinations or 5 sources to 4 destinations. I don't remember what it was, but it was actually kind of surprising the amount of data it was able to ingest and then put back out. And I hadn't seen pricing on it. I didn't realize it was going to be cheaper than the TD3.
Yeah, so the TD3 is like $2,995 or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
I found something somewhere saying that this Talon was going to be $1,495, so basically half the price
right.
of the TD3.
Yeah, the one thing about the TD3, and Chris Cran had actually mentioned this to me, and then I got to see it now firsthand when we got it, is it writes only to XFAT, EXT2, and EXT3. They have no FAT32 or NTFS support, which kind of, I was like, okay, I don't quite understand why you did that, but okay. I mean, I knew about XFAT because they had told us about that before, and the TD2 had only done FAT32. It wouldn't write to NTFS. But I was kind of surprised to see EX2 and EX2.
Four. Yeah. I mean, it may well be to they don't have to pay the license fees or whatever else for using FAT and then, well, I guess FAT's open now, isn't it? But NTFS, yeah. They would have to pay some kind of licensing fee to Microsoft for that, I imagine. But it does seem a bit strange. Whenever we're seeing a lot more forensic devices now that have embedded systems in, I mean, there's not really any excuse not to be able to use, you know, some kind of embedded Windows or something like that in order to get the use of NTFS out of a device like that. I mean, I've got a review unit for Cellbrite, new Cellbrite Touch, which I'm going to be reviewing for the next issue of 4Mag. And
I still haven't read.
What?
I was actually going to read it the other day, and I couldn't find it on my tablet.
Banning you. I've been looking at that, and that's got embedded Windows XP on it, and you know that allows you to write out to NTFS and everything else. So it's really, really handy. I don't understand why more people haven't taken advantage of stuff like that. But, I mean, I'm not saying the TD3 is by any means not a good piece of equipment because it's certainly before this Falcon came along, it was the only thing which dealt with all these different inputs at once. So I can see XT. I can see XFAT because that's cross-platform. You know, you can use XFAT devices on Linux, on Mac, on Windows. So it does kind of make sense. But to not have any FAT support at all, I'm not really sure I follow why that is.
Yeah, but I mean, kind of getting back to the Falcon, since I got you off track. It actually looks kind of neat. I'll be curious to see how it compares with the dossier, because I know you guys have the dossier, or at least you used to. I don't know if you still have it.
Oh, it's still there.
It's still there. And you know, when we were playing around with it, it works fairly well. I mean, I had some concerns with it. The interface on it. The nice thing about the TD's line is at least you can plug a USB keyboard into it and use a regular keyboard. That was always a bonus. And the funny part was, the person I've been working with on trying these out with is not in the forensic industry at all. He's more in a support role. And that was one of his kind of comments about the dossier was, oh, you know, it'd be nice if we could plug in the USB keyboard to type into this thing instead of using the punch pad. There are certain things about both of those, the NetConnect and the dossier, in terms of how they did things. I'll be curious to see if they've improved upon that or changed it in the Falcon.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to having a closer look at that. I think we're probably going to order one at work to see what it's like. But it certainly looks like it's going to go head to head with the TD one, and at half the price, you've got to really think that it's going to be at least worth a gamble.
Now, does it have like the SAS support and the other types of drives? That was the one thing that I know. Like the nice thing about the TD3 is it has those little modular attachments that does the IDE portion, and it has a SAS piece.
But they're modules, though, aren't they? Don't you have to pay extra for those on the TD3?
You know, I don't know. The kit we got had them already.
Okay.
Or I don't know about the SAS one. Maybe it didn't have that. I don't know. But I think we got the complete kit. But it's hard to say. I mean, I don't think the first whole unit is just the base and the LCD screen. I think you get at least the IDE module with it. I could be wrong. I don't know.
Oh, no. Yep, I see it actually now. The unit provides built-in support for SAS, SATA, USB, FireWire, drive interfaces. And IDE, eSATA, mSATA, microSATA, flash drives, so on and so forth. So, yeah, I mean, it seems like it's an extraordinary deal. So, fingers crossed it will be as good as they profess it will be.
Yep. There's only one more month to find out.
Even if it does look like something from Star Trek. And those
are. But isn't that really what we've always wanted?
Yeah. I would really like a way to teleport the evidence directly into my lab so I don't have to go anywhere.
Yeah.
Can we arrange that? Or I can just teleport there, start the imaging, teleport back to the office. Yeah. That'd be nice.
You have to put a force field around it to keep chain of custody.
No. All I can say is I'm sorry. And I feel embarrassed on Tom's behalf. Anyone familiar with me and who's Googled me on, who's looked me up on YouTube, we're well familiar with my my connection with Star Trek there, thank you very much. So, anyway. All right, so, I think that's pretty much all the stuff I really wanted to cover today. The only other thing, only couple of things I wanted to just touch on briefly is that, first of all, the Forensic Forecast Awards are happening on July 9th. It's been moved around a little bit. July 9th at 6 p.m. Central Time, and that's happening in Austin at the Omni Hotel as part of the SANS DFIR Summit. So the last couple of years, it's been streamed live, but there's been no recordings of it available anywhere, so you should be able to watch it live. If not, I'm trying to arrange for someone to record it for me, and we'll see how that goes.
You should see if you can hook up a recorder or something into their output feed and just get it directly from their feed.
It's not a bad idea. Unfortunately, that's going to require some advanced planning, and you know, that's not something I really do well. The voting for that has closed now. It closed at the start of June, and so please watch it and cheer on for the people who win the awards and commiserate those who didn't quite make it. It's always a little bit of fun, and sometimes it's serious, sometimes it's a bit tongue in cheek. So
I hear Inside the Core has the inside track on Podcast of the Year again.
We removed that award this year.
Oh, did you? Okay.
Yeah. We figured that, you know, Forensic Forecast didn't put out anything almost the whole of last year. Ovi didn't put anything out the whole of last year.
No, I thought he did. I thought he did towards the end of the year. He started banging out like 4 or 5 episodes.
Oh, I don't think he's done a podcast episode for 2 or 3 years now. Inside the Core haven't done anything. Joe Garcia hasn't done anything. So I thought, oh, you know what? This isn't going to work this year, so we'll just drop it for this year and see what happens next year again. But it's such a small pool to choose from that I don't want it to be like, I don't want it to look like I'm just trying to win an award every year. You know, a self-made award. It looks really quite sad, you know.
You can start putting them on the wall behind you.
One sitting in my office at work. It is sad. And then finally, the last thing is that we talked about this briefly just a few minutes ago, is that 4Mag is the Forensic Forecast magazine, which we put out about 3 months ago, or almost 2 and a bit months ago. And it's really good read. You should definitely have a look at that. And we had a little challenge in there.
Did anyone ever solve the challenge?
Yeah. A few people have done. I think I've had 4 or 5 people contact me with the solution. But don't let that deter you from trying it, because it's quite fun. I made it really sadistic, and I thought it was quite difficult. And the fact that only 5 people have done it probably testifies to that fact. But the thing is that the first person who got it did it, sent me the email with the solution within the day of the magazine being published. So Someone is very, very smart, and they've agreed to do the write-up for the magazine about the solution. So that's cool. We'll have that in the next issue. But the next issue, I think we're going to publish just after the SANS DFIR Summit, just so I can get pictures and stuff for the of the awards to put in the magazine. If you got any interest in writing for the magazine, whether it's just a one-off article, whether you want to do a series of articles, whether you want to be a featured columnist every month, then by all means, please get in touch. Twitter, Facebook, comment on the Forensic Forecast website, LinkedIn, anywhere. It's not difficult to get in touch with us. We'd really like to see some more people get involved. So this is another one of those things where I'd really like this to be a bit like the Forensic Forecast Awards themselves, where it's largely community-driven. I'd like to just set the ball rolling and not have to spend days and days on end trying to find content to fill it. Please, if you've got anything at all, it doesn't have to be technical. It can be something relating to people in the field or how to deal with certain issues, technical or otherwise. I'm hoping this is going to be a very good thing for the future. So please get in touch and let me know. Tom.
Yes.
Thanks for joining us again. You are old, faithful, and reliable.
I'm going for Eric's record.
Yes, alas, poor Eric, we knew him well.
He moved to Tampa and we haven't seen him since.
Eric, we miss you.
Hey, are you, real quick, are you, for the Forecast Awards, are you doing the same type of award again, like you've been doing?
The hard drives?
Yeah.
Yeah. I think so.
Very cool. Those are really nice. Those really look really nice.
They are nice, and they're also the cheapest option by far. Like I said, I'm a real cheapskate. So, they are very, very nice. And this year will be the first time it has the new Forensic Forecast logo on as well, which you can go and have a look at on the Forensic Forecast website. So, yeah, Tom, thanks a lot for joining us again. It's been a pleasure, and your insight has been invaluable.
Thank you.
Where can people find you?
You can find me on Twitter as CDT Delta. That's pretty much it.
Yeah. He's not one of these people who goes on Facebook and publishes all this information on there.
Going back to an earlier topic. So I am on Google. I am on Google Plus, so I can be found there.
Awesome. All right. And you can find me on Twitter, Lee_Whitfield or Forecast. And I'm on Facebook and Google Plus, LinkedIn.
You're just giving everybody all your information.
I'm a social media whore. All right, cool. Well, thank you very much, everyone, for joining us again. And hopefully we will see you at the SANS Forensic Summit. If not, join us shortly thereafter for the next installment of the unofficial Forensic Forecast Awards. Oh, it'll be fun, especially if I get photoshopped or something again. But as for now, thanks a lot. Bye for now.